You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. On Monday, President Biden announced that Wisconsin will be designated as one of 31 regional innovation and technology hubs in the country. The Technology Hubs program was authorized by the CHIPS and Science Act signed by President Biden in August 2022. Wisconsin's tech hub designation will focus on supporting the state's growing biohealth sector. Here's President Biden during that announcement.
A tech hub in Wisconsin, they're going to bring together research labs, medical device manufacturers, and engineers. They're going to build technology that supports personalized medicine, like tests, treatments, and therapies specifically tailored to a patient's genetic code and medical records. And I believe it's going to save a lot of lives in the long run.
That's President Biden speaking early last week. A state technology and business advocate joins us now for a look at what this could mean for Wisconsin's economy and for the future of healthcare research. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in the healthcare or biohealth industry? What does this mean for your organization? Are you watching this hub with interest? Are you excited potentially about this recognition for Wisconsin's health and biohealth industries? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tom Still is president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, a nonprofit bipartisan science and technology policy advisory board to the governor and state legislature. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Great to be back.
What does this designation as a technology hub mean? Is it just kind of a label, or does it come with a little help attached to it?
Yes. Well, it does, at least at the outset, come with some little with some help to help push things along. It is one of the 31 tech hub designations that were made by the U.S. Department of Commerce through the president's office. And it is all about precision medicine, which is also known as personalized medicine. So there were five others in that cluster out of the 31 who would be working in that area. This comes with planning money of about $350,000. And somewhere in the range of 50 to 70 million if the tech hub is fully funded moving down the road. And that's still a very competitive piece.
Before we look more at the details of what this would mean for personalized medicine, Tom, can you talk about biotechnology in Wisconsin? I think in some ways it's kind of a hidden part of the economy for a lot of people. What is included in that?
Yeah, I mean, we have long been, as a state, a center for research and clinical applications in human health for more than a century, really. I mean, it includes things such as vitamin discoveries, many of which took place at the UW-Madison, the founding of the nation's first college genetics department, which is really directly linked to precision medicine. Breakthroughs in organ transplants, cancer therapies, medical imaging, and it's, here on the Madison campus at places like Marquette and the Medical College of Wisconsin all have a piece of it, as well as our companies. That's the really important part of that structure. You know, you've got companies as large as GE Health, Exact Sciences, Epic Systems, Promega, Arrowhead Pharmaceuticals, many, many more that are in that space. So the strength of this particular tech hub application really is part on the research side, part traditionally where we are strong. And by the way, just genetic medicine in general is a part of that. And then where it intersects with clinicians and others who are making the right products and doing the right things.
Now, part of the goal, as I understand it, of these hubs around the country, Tom, is they said something like this in the announcement. Yeah, we've got a lot of Silicon Valley type places. We got Boston and MIT, a lot of coastal technology hubs. Is this something that you see as part of the goal is here that's going to get more technology development, technology business development in places in the Midwest like Wisconsin?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, part of it is just recognizing, what are the good things that are already going on here? And this is also the tech hub designation is similar to what is going on in a parallel process through the National Science Foundation, where they have been doing and announced earlier this year regional innovation engine programs 44 of which spread around the country. The type one, that means it's early, just like this tech hub is early. And two of those 44 are in Wisconsin. So, and the other one is just across the border in Chicago, and that also has a Wisconsin component. So really, right now, we have, as a state, four different proposals that are kind of on the table and could wind up with some significant federal support, along with private support, to push things ahead for years to come.
Talking to Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, about a federal designation of Wisconsin as having a biotechnology hub and giving some support to develop that here. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have questions about what this means, about personalized medicine, which is one of the goals of this project here in Wisconsin. If you work for one of the companies Tom just mentioned or comparable ones here in the state, love to hear from you as well. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tom, as you mentioned, genetic medicine, personalized medicine, the target of the Wisconsin hub here. So what's that going to look like? What institutions are involved? What kind of things will happen to try to develop that?
Well, I want to give credit right off the bat to some folks who did a lot of heavy lifting to move this along. The Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation helped convene a lot of people. BioForward is a longstanding group that is really dedicated quite vertically to what's going on with human health in Wisconsin. And so there are a variety of partners, both private and public sector, that are a part of this. And so that's an exciting part. Now, we as a tech council, we're part of all three of those NSF grants that I talked about earlier. Those are $1 million planning grants and up to $160 million over 10 years each, if those are designated. So the Water Council of Milwaukee has taken the lead on one about water, energy, and manufacturing. WISIS has taken the lead on one with sustainable agriculture. And the Quantum Computing Hub is run out of Chicago, but it includes elements of things that are going on in Wisconsin. So, again, that's the four and some of the folks who've been driving it. And we're pleased to be a part of those, part of that overall mix.
Now, again, with the personalized medicine in particular, what are the hopes for that field as far as things that, again, new innovation that could come out of Wisconsin?
Well, let's look at, for example, GE Healthcare, for example, and Accuray, which is both are precision medicine in the sense of medical therapies, targeted radiation, for example. Shine Technologies in Janesville and North Star Radioactive Isotopes are both producing or will be producing isotopes that are used and can be very targeted in all kinds of treatments that are common today. And then, on that genetic side, really at the end of the day, personalized medicine is trying to find the right treatment, the right technique, targeted to the right people based on their makeup, based up on how they might be ill, what their genetic makeup looks like. And it's really all about having it precise versus more general, which was the practice for years and years.
I talked to the author of a book a while back who raised red flags about personalized medicine, saying, in effect, we'd get a lot more bang for our buck if we boosted access to, basic, primary care physicians in rural areas, low-income areas, things like that. I don't know. Is there a worry, Tom, that we're putting money into this kind of gosh wow stuff when there's lower-hanging fruit out there?
Well, and remember that in all of these cases with, precision medicine, with the tech hub, whether it's the Wisconsin proposal or the one in Minneapolis or Philadelphia or Birmingham, all of them are building on work that has already been done. And they're trying to bring it to the next level. So, yes, should we be thinking more about rural health? I think the answer is yes. But do these efforts take away from that? No, because I think precision medicine can be just as easily used by places like the Marshfield Clinic, which covers a lot of rural Wisconsin, as in some of the big urban hospitals. So I think it can apply wherever people live and work.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Liz is with us in Lyon. Liz, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Liz? Oop, we put Liz back on hold, I think. Liz, there you go. Hi, what did you want to bring up, Liz? Oh, no, I think we lost her. We'll see if we can get her back on. In the meantime, Tom Still is president of the Wisconsin Technology Council with us for a look at the recent news that Wisconsin is receiving $750 million in federal funding to boost biohealth technology in the state. Whether the state's new technology hub status is just a buzzword or could lead to meaningful growth in the field in the future, you could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Wisconsin being designated a tech hub by the federal government, about Wisconsin's biotechnology and health research industries and academics, for that matter? If you are a part of this kind of research, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Wisconsin Technology Council President Tom Still about Wisconsin's designation as a regional technology hub, what it means for healthcare technology and innovation in the state. That comes with $75 million in federal funding to boost biohealth research. I think I said $750 million, $75 million. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what this is, what it means, about biotechnology and its and research and its role in Wisconsin's economy? Maybe you could tell us about its role in your personal economy if you work in these fields. Join in at 800-642-1234. We have Liz in Lyon now. Liz, hi. What did you want to bring up?
Hi. I was just wondering what these companies are perhaps doing about making continuous glucose monitors, insulin pumps, and just general insulin cheaper and more available to people who have not as good insurance or no insurance at all.
Liz, thanks for the call. Tom, I don't know if that'll be part of the research hub here in Wisconsin, but I think there's a lot of interest in providing access to good insulin tech, diabetes-related technology.
Right. There are, of the 31 tech hubs that were designated, 11 of them are in medicine and health. So just so people know that it's other things like energy and quantum and critical minerals and all of that that will be a part of this program too. Now, of those other 11 that are in medical, I'm sure that they're going to be mostly not in the group that Wisconsin's in, but the other group is going to be about pharma ingredients, fermentation, biomanufacturing, vaccine-related work, biologics manufacturing. Those are going to be in other hubs where that kind of study and advancements can take place. And by the way, the one in Wisconsin is $350,000 for a planning grant and a chance to compete for up to $70 million per hub to work with private businesses, increase competitiveness, and, of course, in the case of these health hubs, save and improve lives. So I would suspect that somewhere out there, there will be an effort to work on things such as insulin pumps and the future of insulin and what else comes with that. So it's just probably not in this precision medicine cluster that Wisconsin's a part of.
Liz, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Tom, can you talk some more about biotechnology's role in Wisconsin's economy? How big a deal is it for communities around the state?
Well, it's really a big deal in several ways. First, there's some of the major companies that I mentioned. The Exact Sciences and Promegas and Epic Systems is not necessarily, biotech, obviously not. They're about medical records. But companies like that, that's a big part. There are other emerging companies that are really becoming a big part of the economy in Wisconsin. Some clustered in Madison area, some in Milwaukee area, but around the state as well. There are emerging companies. In fact, we have a conference next week where there's going to be some of those companies presenting. And then you have investors around the state who are also investing in some of those, especially young companies. So there's a lot of ways that it's really happening. I mean, when you look at major research institutions, the UW-Madison, the Medical College of Wisconsin, Marshfield Clinics, those are folks who are bringing in research dollars, always have, in fairly big amounts that can be a part of the economy as well. And finally, you don't have to be a biotech company or a digital imaging company to take part in the supply chain. So you often see these companies buying very close to home from folks who are in other sectors of the economy across Wisconsin.
Tom, there's an argument that, the market should be making these decisions. Why have the federal involvement? Why the competition for $75 million for these various hubs? These things will find their own way through.
The private sector has moved a lot on it, but with some things, and you could look at some of the history of federal intervention around science and technology over time. If you go back to 1945, there was the Endless Frontier, which Vannevar Bush, who was an advisor of President Truman, advised that here's how we're going to get some things done in this country moving ahead in a post-war environment, and it included creating the National Science Foundation. If you look a little farther along, there's the start of the space age. There's been some federal involvement in a variety of technologies that are in the health space, especially around what's going on with genetics and other types of really, personalized medicine. And now this. So it's not an entirely unusual amount or unprecedented way for the federal government to get involved. And here, it really, especially with the NSF, and I think this is the case with the Tech Hub too, the NSF really wants this to become a private sector initiative over time. This is money they see as being used to jumpstart great projects and then move them ahead and help create jobs and really make the country much more resilient in so many different areas.
Talking to Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, about a federal designation of Wisconsin as a technology hub, specifically for biotechnology, some financial support, possibly more in the offing from the federal government. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. Let's go back to our callers. Madeline is with us in Green Bay. Madeline, hi.
Hi. I hope that there'll be something about this that will help to deal with Lyme disease. Wisconsin is the fourth state in the nation with Lyme disease and all the autoimmune issues that come with it. And the tourism is a big economy thing in Wisconsin. But it's such a beautiful state, but you got to be afraid to go in the woods. So I hope they do something about Lyme disease.
Madeline, thanks for the call. Tom, we're maybe getting ahead of the research a little here, but is there any hope for personalized medicine related to Lyme disease, to autoimmune disorders, and more?
It feels to me like it's more a matter of generalized biologics. And again, it might not take place here in Wisconsin, but it may. There's parts of this that could be applicable in different companies, different hubs. But for example, Kansas City has a hub around biologics, and that's going to not that far away. And the caller is exactly right. I mean, there are things that are everyday conditions or diseases that may be touched by this project over time. Either here in Wisconsin or one of these other places that have made it through the cut. And by the way, I think there were something like 400 different entities that applied for a Tech Hub grant and designation. And so it feels pretty good that Wisconsin is among them, and the same with those NSF programs.
Thanks for the call, Madeline. And Tom, as you mentioned, we made the cut for this Tech Hub designation. That's not the end of the competitive process, though, to get the bigger grants. What is next? What are the next steps to get from here to there?
Well, you're exactly right, Rob. I think it's having the right planning and the right involvement of all those different entities that we've been talking about, whether it's big companies, emerging companies, private investors who maybe, want to take a look at some of the things that are happening. the combination of the existing research in the public sector as well as in the private sector, I think is probably one of the things that really tipped it to our advantage. Plus, we're a good state for medical manufacturing. Let's take, for example, Accuray. They bought TomoTherapy in Madison not too long ago. They're a California-based company. Guess what? They're moving all of their operations to Wisconsin and Madison. So there's talent here. There's the ability to get things done, get them produced, and to research them. So I think it's that total package that probably really interested the Department of Commerce in the Wisconsin Tech Hub.
And Tom, as we wrap up, let's talk about Wisconsin's reputation. I think if people outside the state think of, you know, what's made in Wisconsin, they might think of beer, cheese, and Harleys. Nothing wrong with those. But do you think that Wisconsin's reputation is starting to include being a center for technology and science?
I totally agree, and that it is getting better. And you think about these areas. Biohealth has been a part of Wisconsin flavor for years. It's reached the point now where people are beginning to recognize it coast to coast. With the NSF hubs, the notion of fresh water, energy innovation, manufacturing, one of the top three manufacturing states in the country, sustainable agriculture, that's the WISIS grant. I mean, you know, who does agriculture better than Wisconsin? And then computing, where we have seen a lot of growth in that strength. So I really do think that this is a critical moment to message people around the country, around the world, that Wisconsin really has all that it takes in this new tech age, as well as what it takes to succeed in some of the success, older sectors that are still very, very prolific.
Tom, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, you're so welcome, Rob. Thank you.
Been talking to Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, a nonprofit bipartisan science and technology policy advisory board. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, social media sites use our personal data a lot. Now here comes artificial intelligence. We'll look at our privacy in the age of AI. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. If you've seen changes in the dress codes at your job, you're not alone. Many workplaces across industries, especially in office settings, have adopted relaxed policies and guidelines about what employees can wear to work. That includes, for a little while anyway, Congress. Recently, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer made a short-lived change to the U.S. Senate dress code to allow senators to wear pretty much whatever they want on the floor. Republicans in Congress and some Democrats criticized the move, saying the Senate should be a place of professionalism and decorum. Democratic Senator John Fetterman from Pennsylvania came under particular scrutiny for wearing basketball shorts and hoodies to Capitol Hill. Here's Chris Hayes interviewing Senator Fetterman on MSNBC.
Let me start with the most important matter facing our country at this dire moment, which is the matter of the Senate dress code, which has recently been changed.
Of course. I've heard that some people are upset about that. And you know, like I said, aren't there more important things we should be talking about rather than if I dress like a slob?
Days after the change, the Senate passed a bipartisan resolution reinstating business attire on the Senate floor. Our next guest is a fashion historian who says a recent trend toward casual wear at work isn't a reason to panic. Fashions come and go, but it does represent an interesting shift in our culture. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What is the dress code like where you work? Have standards loosened in recent years? Are you happy about a move to more casual and comfortable workwear in many settings? Or are there places where dressier professional clothes should make a comeback? And do you work at a place where there's no choice? You wear the scrubs or the uniform or the safety gear. Are you glad you don't have to think about what to wear? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Linda Prebyszewski is an associate professor of history at the University of Notre Dame, author of The Lost Art of Dress. Linda, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks, Rob.
Most of us don't work in the U.S. Senate, Linda, but when this story broke, this is a little while back, do you think it was something worth thinking about and paying some attention to?
I was curious as to what the purpose was, because the Senate usually takes itself pretty darn seriously. And then I saw some pictures of Fetterman, and I thought, okay, I think I'm against Jim Shorts in the Capitol.
Now, is this, and I've mentioned a couple times, it seems like more workplaces are getting a little more casual. Do you see that happening? And if so, why?
Well, there was a shift towards what they used to call Casual Friday in, I'm thinking, the late 90s, the early aughts. And the interesting thing was women actually found it annoying because they felt they now needed a third wardrobe, right? Formal work wardrobe at home with kids, with family, informal wardrobe, and then something in between. But now it's turned into sort of casual Friday all the time, casual every day. This is the thing, though, that I find interesting. It's also casual even if you would like to dress up, because there are places like Silicon Valley where there are people who have, quite frankly, enormous amounts of money, and yet they're not supposed to wear the beautifully tailored suit that they can afford, you know, because that's not what they're supposed to be wearing. And I think there are different dress codes, but they might be just as annoying to some people as they were before they got really casual.
Now, there are written dress codes for some businesses, but there are also sort of unwritten rules that people don't necessarily come in knowing. Is that something you've watched for, and how complicated can that make things, especially for somebody who's new in the workforce?
Yeah, it's. I mean, most of the people who kind of try to keep young people aware of what they need to think about tell them you need to do, I teach at college, right? So you have young people going into careers, into offices for the first time. And the usual rule is try to dress a little better than you think you're supposed to, if only so people don't think you're slacking off. And then you sort of look around and you realize, okay, what's appropriate, what's considered appropriate in this particular setting. You know, more creative places, they expect you to be more creative in your dressing, whereas places usually like financial places, right, they expect you to be more conservative because nobody going into a bank or an investment firm really wants to feel nervous about somebody's appearance.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Kaukauna. Michael, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I remember when I started my career in the professional world, I was required to wear, you know, decent dress slacks, a tie, a dress shirt, and a jacket of some kind. And now I see people in work and in church in T-shirts and in cut off jeans with holes in them. I'm going, like, it's gone too far to the casual side. Is how do we strike a balance between the two where people could be comfortable and yet be professional?
Michael, thanks a lot for bringing that up. And Linda, there is a lot of room between, you know, a jacket and tie and those cut off jeans with holes in them.
Yeah, no, and obviously being female, I've never been forced to wear a tie against my will. And I do know that there are a fair number of men who simply find the way they fit around the neck to be uncomfortable. But I do think Mike is right that there's got to be a happy medium where, let's put it this way. My rule is, unless you clean garages for a living, you should probably be aiming a little higher than that, simply in order to signal competence to people. And that's one of the things I always think about when I see college students going off to, right, the career fair on campus, is one of the reasons they've put on a suit of some kind or a jacket is that has traditionally been in a way that you said, I'm a person who is competent and in charge of something, and I'm ready to work for you.
Thanks for that call, Michael. We're talking about dress codes at work, whether they exist, how they've changed. Are we getting more casual? Should we get less casual? Linda Prebyszewski is with us, Associate Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame. You can join in with your thoughts, maybe what you see at your workplace at 800-642-1234. Linda, I am a guy. I don't love wearing ties. Large Adam's apple doesn't work well for me. But I don't know that guys get a real pity party here. Can you talk about the challenges facing women in trying to decide how to go along with the dress code? It's a little easier for guys in many settings.
No, it is. It's true because, quite frankly, in the early 19th century, this is how far back it goes. There's actually someone who wrote a book called Men in Black. The color options and the decorative options for men narrowed. Right, so the color palette got much narrower, much darker, except for playwear. But for serious business wear, right, we got the dark suit. Women have always had a much broader, wider range of clothing available to them. And because culturally, right, fashion has pushed women to expose more flesh and form through their clothing, it's often put them in this awkward situation where they want to be taken seriously as someone working for a living and not someone dating for a living. And yet a lot of the options for women are for dating, right? They're for the big night out. They're not for the office. And it's funny because we really lost, i.e., here's my book, The Lost Art of Dress, a whole set of amazing suit options which existed in the 1950s for women. Where I'm talking, they didn't just look like men's blazers. I actually think women moved into men's blazers in the 70s because they'd forgotten all the amazing options in suits and in what they called dress with jacket looks. But there used to be a very large array of pretty much formal, pretty much covered up, and yet extremely attractive kind of suit options for women. And nowadays it's kind of, I have to say, sometimes it's sort of like every single woman is wearing those pair of black trousers. And you have to realize I love color, I'm a dressmaker, and there are many other options that are dark and serious enough colors, but they're not what I call boring black.
Let's go back to our callers now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I recently had eye surgery plus many other visits at the Eye Institute here in Milwaukee, which is connected with Frederick Hospital. Everybody who examined me using very ultra-sophisticated pieces of instrumentation wore such sloppy clothes that I was very dismayed. Most of the people looked as if they had been brought off the street and given 20 minutes of instruction. And I think that this is because hospitals now have the feeling that all patients get into a panic and get elevated blood pressure if they're treated by somebody wearing a white lab coat and very professional-looking clothing. And so they've gone overboard. And the people who treated me had crumpled T-shirts, stained and dirty jeans, jeans with holes in the knees, just deplorable clothing. And I will never go back there again because in an effort to calm patients' nerves, they're forcing people who probably would have preferred to have dressed more in a professional manner, but they're forcing them to come to work in overalls. I mean,
I gotcha. Nancy, I hope the recovery is going okay, by the way. Linda, Nancy, not wild about seeing people underdressed in that medical setting.
Well, to me, the part that really dismayed me the most was people who didn't look like they were clean in the medical center. I mean, one of the things that's really obvious if you look historically at nurses and doctors has always been, right, the original outfits were all white, right? And the idea was, man, those things look bleached. They looked really, really clean. They looked really, really hygienic. And then we saw the move to scrubs, where everyone started wearing scrubs. I'm presuming simply because they're more comfortable, but I think I myself would agree that I do want people to at least look really clean if it's in any kind of medical care setting.
Thanks a lot for that call, Nancy. We're talking to Linda Prebyszewski, Associate Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame. We're talking about the rise of casual clothing in the workplace, when it gets too casual, in your opinion, and what, if anything, it says about society. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you wear to work? If you could wave a wand and change your workplace's dress code, what changes would you make? Do you have no choice about what to wear to work? Because there's a uniform or a scrubs requirement, or you name it. You glad you don't have to think about what to wear? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with fashion historian Linda Prebyszewski about how a lot of workplaces, especially offices, are relaxing their dress codes. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you ever have casual Friday at a workplace? Did you love it or dread it? What do you think? Do you have examples of where people you think are overdressed or underdressed when you encounter them at work? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Dave is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Dave, hello.
Yeah, hi. I was a teacher, and the administrator we had was really big on, if you're going to be a professional, you have to act professional, you should look professional. And it was really interesting. It did garner respect from the students. I think it made a difference. And it's if you can't walk in like a rag doll and expect to get respect from that. And it is a part of the whole picture. And I hated dressing up. I'm a very casual, but it made a difference.
And Dave, in this context, did it mean you wore a suit up in front of the class, or just like nice clothes but short of a suit?
Nice clothes, no jeans. Many of the males, the guys were wearing ties and things like that. I had a non-traditional where it was a possible danger. I did not wear a tie, but I never wore jeans, and it was good. I hated it, but it worked. I think you need to garner respect, and you would look different from the students. You were not them.
Gotcha. Dave, thanks a lot. Linda, this idea that as a teacher or in other settings, we are dressing to set ourselves apart from the people we're encountering in our workday.
Yeah. I mean, when people in the past were taught how to dress, and they literally were taught how to dress, that's what my book is about. One of the things the dress advisor said is, look, when you're out in a public place, and the workplace is one of those places, it's not an intimate setting. It's not where you reveal yourself to people. So in some ways, your clothing needs to be more formal because it's sending the message, hi, we're all here to do something, in particular, work. And the other thing I think of as a teacher is there is an institutional power imbalance, right? And to me, sort of like not having students call me by my first name, the fact that I am not trying to dress like them either is part of it. We're not on the same kind of level institutionally. I'm their professor. And clothing does send a message, as Dave said in his call. And clearly his students got that message.
Dave, thanks for the call. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. My senior year at Notre Dame, I was a fireman. I wasn't volunteer, was paid, but we didn't have a uniform. And I told them when I graduated, I wish Notre Dame Fire Department had a uniform. Well, years later, as an alum, suddenly there's a corner in the bookstore where you could get all this Notre Dame Fire Department apparel. And I was like, I wish I had that when I was, you know, doing the job, because I always admired Star Trek. You know, they had a uniform, they were on duty. And I always liked, you know, the military uniform looks really good. I think a person looks sharp when you have a uniform.
Jeff, I'm sorry you didn't get royalties, because that was your idea for that uniform. Thanks for the call, Jeff. Yeah, I mean, uniforms answer a lot of these questions, Linda, for better or worse.
Right, they do. And they also send a message about being a member of something bigger than yourself, right? You're a member of a corps. It's funny because very often people will say, well, fashion's for women, only women care about fashion. And I point out that actually military men feel very strongly about their uniforms. And sometimes it's just because they want their uniforms to function, right? But if you've ever seen the Marines in their dress uniforms, you know they also care about the style of it and how good looking it is as well.
Thanks for the call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. Looking at changing dress codes at work, Linda Prebyszewski stays with us, Associate Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame. We'll go now to Matt in Waukesha. Matt, hi.
Hello. I was something you hit on just a few moments ago. The idea of this workplace dress code, I think, is a part of a larger public versus private sort of space, which you kind of just mentioned. And it probably comes from a good place of wanting to try to break down some barriers of what, you know, is a stereotype of who's dressing this way and what spaces. But I think it also loses its function, like you said, of like the uniform is a great example of that actually too. Like, you know, who is, you know, this, who is the firefighter, who's a paramedic, who is a policeman, if everybody wears a jacket that says that on the back or whatnot, or whether it's teacher, student.
Matt, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. And Linda, that blurring of public-private, well, we had this period where many people in lines of work were working at home, yes. And that may have, how much did that change our thinking about clothing?
I think it did because there were a whole lot of people who did or did not dress. I actually dressed to Zoom classes, so my position was nothing had really changed. Of course, I was trying to reassure, right, a group of undergraduates who was going through one of the most confusing times in their education. But I was also thinking about the fact that I do think there are people who got sick of the not dressing up at all. I think there's a reason why once restaurants opened, people wanted to go out and be in them, and they wanted to go out at night, and they wanted to be able to celebrate. And usually when you actually celebrate some event, you want to wear something special to mark that occasion. So I think, I mean, and to me, the art of dress is actually the ability to dress for everything from, yes, I'm going to clean my garage today or walk my dog or do my gardening too. I am ready for a formal, beautiful event where I get to wear something that's special that I don't get to wear every day.
Thanks for that call. Now, I think sometimes, Linda, when people talk about things like changing dress codes, there can be on the one hand a sense that, okay, society's in decline, kids today, on the other hand, like from the other end of the spectrum, come on, give it up, things change, whatever. Where do you fall on that huge spectrum?
Well, I kind of do what the dress advisors of old said, which was I look across all the fashion possibilities, and I choose those that I think best suit my life, and my body and my coloring, and I get to have that choice. And one of the things too, I think, especially I'm an older woman now, is that I do actually prefer to have an emphasis on dignity rather than an emphasis on following the latest thing, because I've seen a lot of the latest things coming and going. And what was very fashionable in, you know, 1 year, 5 years later was looked at as perfectly silly. So I'd like to pick what actually works for me out of all the possibilities. And then enjoy it. Enjoy it as fashion and enjoy it as clothing.
Linda, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Hey, you're welcome. It was fun to be here.
That's Linda Prebyszewski, Associate Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame. She joined us for a look at the recent trend toward more casual dress codes at many workplaces. Hey, one more comment. Frances in Milton wanted to say she thinks business casual could be nice slacks with a nice blouse for women, nice pullover sweater for men. Also, I have a note. She would like to know what Rob is wearing. Well, like every day here, full tuxedo, top hat, tails, my little monocle. No, I am very casual. Radio is a very Rob-friendly profession. Intact, usually blue jeans. Black jeans today, though, mixing things up. A usual button-up shirt, but untucked. That's just how I roll. I kind of stumbled into that. So the height of, am I a slob? I'm looking to Sarah here. No, I'm not a slob. But I'm not, you know, dressed in a suit on any given day, or if I can avoid it, any day. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
We'll be right back.